All right, here's what we have to now. Episode 3, 4, something like that. This is going to be the second live episode, so it doesn't really matter. Anyway, here's another list of articles I'm doing for What's in Your Pocket. Decided to take a bit of a different approach this time. I've got a bunch of articles queued up in reverse chronological order, and I'll just get through those in my own time until we've hit about the half-hour mark. So that way, there's no need to rush through things. First article that I came across here that's of note is from, I got this one from SBS News. Donald Trump tweets apparent support for protesters of COVID-19 stay-at-home orders. So this one is targeting specifically Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. He tweeted out, "Liberate Michigan," in an apparent reference to sharp criticism that included street protests over her strict measures to tamp down on the outbreak in her state. You may have seen a bit of stuff around this. I'd seen some stuff as well, that there are people out there in the states who are protesting the shutdown and the stay-at-home orders, that they just want to go out and buy their lawn fertilizer and whatnot. And they're driving around in their cars, parking out the front of City Hall, blocking off ambulances, and demanding that someone speak to the virus's manager and the whole shutdown for the virus just ends. And now Trump, with his desire to get the economy back going, because that's what he's staked the competency of his administration on, has apparently come out in support of them. What also makes this a bit more interesting, with the specific targeting of Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, is she's rumored to be the potential nominee for Biden's vice president. As you know, that he went out saying that whoever he gets as his vice president is going to be a woman. And so a lot of people have been looking at her and the way that she's been able to manage the crisis in her state and have speculated that it may be her, hence his targeting. Here's another article, a little bit of something different. This one's from IGN. Animal Crossing has sparked an insane turnip black market. If none of that makes any sense to you, a quick summary is that you can buy turnips from a pig with a runny nose on a Sunday, and the price of turnips to sell fluctuates and changes the morning and evening every day of the week thereafter, and turnips are only good for a week. If you do not sell them come next Sunday, they go rotten and you lose the money that you spent on them. People have been calling it the stalk market because that's essentially what you have to do. You need to, in a way, gamble to get the best prices on your turnips and make more money, which in the game are called bells. This is quite interesting, though, that this isn't just a turnip price speculation, as it says here in the article. Twitter user Ninji, a 25-year-old software developer who has previously built tools for games like Super Mario Bros. Wii, reverse-engineered Animal Crossing's code using the NSA's free reverse engineering software, Ghidra. Now, I'm sure that last line there, that the NSA has reverse engineering software that's free to anyone, is its own can of worms. But let's just skip over that for the moment, and we'll focus on what's in the article here. So, buried in Animal Crossing's code, there's a flag labeled First Kabul Buy. Kabul is Japanese for turnip, and following that trail led Ninji straight to the turnip pricing code. Of course, they didn't want to make this too obvious for anyone doing this type of data mining, but old Ninji cracked the case. The code that Ninji eventually posted online would go on to help create the Turnip Profit site, created by one Mike Bryant, which lets users use an algorithm to determine, with a fair amount of accuracy, what their turnip prices will be throughout the week. So, if you are playing Animal Crossing you want to speculate on the price of turnips, maybe it's better to have a look at a turnip profit and put in the price of your turnips morning and night in there and see what prices it gives you. That's better. There's a few other tools where you just put in your prices, you get a history, and it uses that data set to guess what's going to happen next. This one seems to use actual cracked game code. So it's interesting what people have been able to do. And if you take Animal Crossing that seriously, you may be losing the spirit of the game a bit, but I understand. You gotta terraform your island and make it look as cute as possible. Here's another one that I saw from thestable.com.au. It's a bunch of free resources around COVID-19 from Shutterstock. As we all know, the Shutterstock, the absolutely terrible stock image website, as is all stock image websites, that because there's a pandemic going on, if you're writing about COVID-19 or you're putting together any other resources, that they have a bunch of free COVID-19 related images and such that you can use. So the resource hub includes curated image collections for use by media partners, including stock images, infographics, and other content. A set of free backgrounds for virtual meetings to improve the look of your home office, and a range of guides and advice posts to enhance your visual efforts. So if you need to put together anything around COVID-19, check out what's on Shutterstock, and it'll just help you be able to put your resources budget into more relevant areas than a picture for the feature image of your article. All right, and here's a bit of a lighter, weird one as well. From PCGamer.com, Stardew Valley creator Eric Baroni finally has a decent desk. And where this one comes from is that in some of the early images of Eric working on Stardew Valley, and even after the game sold, he always seems to be just working on the worst possible desk to build a game that sells 10 million units. But he recently put out an image of himself working, I believe, on a new game or a new update for it, and he finally has a decent desk. But yeah, it's just interesting here that it says that Baroni graduated from college, wasn't having much luck finding a job, so decided to bolster his resume by making a game of his own. What was supposed to be a relatively short project with a modest sales goal took more than 4 years to complete and turn him into a legitimate indie sensation. And because of that, and if you've been playing Stardew Valley, which, if you don't have a Switch or Animal Crossing, has been the other go-to game that people have been talking about, that now you've finally been able to support Eric buying a new desk. Next article here from bnt.com.au. New Zealand TV presenter deeply sorry over spectacularly shit Jacinta Ardern cake. This one's a doozy, that you just got to see this this cake for yourself, because it looks terrible. It says here that Lauren Daniel wanted to pay tribute to her hero, so decided to try her hand at baking her into a cake while in coronavirus lockdown. The Instagram post says, "They say don't bake your heroes, but I wanted to try anyway. I'm deeply sorry, Jacinta Ardern. I truly tried my best with what I had available. It's made from another New Zealand icon lolly cake. Swipe to see my bake-off competitor, Hilary Barry, produce a stunning araki." So yeah, this article will be in the show notes. I'm not even going to begin to try to describe this thing to you, because it looks absolutely terrible. And in that way, at the very least, you can appreciate the effort that went into it, because there's a lot going on with that cake. It's a sight to behold. Here's one from Vice, and there'll be a follow-up article on this one later. It's a dive into the disputed history of Dalgona coffee. This is the coffee that you may have seen around on social media recently that everyone's been making while in lockdown. It's that real frothy, whipped-looking coffee that almost looks like some type of mousse or cream sprayed out of a can. That people have been getting into making it because it just sort of popped up at the right time, didn't it? People are stuck at home all day with nothing to do. That here's a new form of coffee you can make that just uses instant coffee and seems to take a lot of time and effort. That I saw it, and it uses a lot of milk and a lot of sugar, so I've been too interested in trying it myself. But if you've really got nothing else to do, give it a crack. But this article is more focusing on where it came from exactly, because as the article says here, it's easiest to connect Dalgona coffee to Macau, the small shipyard cafe where Jung tried the drink is Honki Cafe, which former shipbuilder Leong Cam Hon opened in the 90s after a workplace accident resulted in the near amputation of his arm. Though his arm was reattached, its weakened state made him consider alternative careers, so he started the cafe for shipyard workers, as CNN reports in 2013. In the process of opening it, he learned Kung Fu, which helped him regain strength and also provided useful for making the labor-intensive drink. So this guy here, Leong, also says that he learned it from a foreign couple in the 2000s who attended the Macau Grand Prix every year. He doesn't know where they were from. I was just trying to put things together in my head with this article. So apparently he started the cafe in the 90s. Then in the 2000s, he was taught how to make this drink. And then one of the big people who debuted this drink on social media got it from him. But there's a twist to the story. Then, in 2004, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon actor Yao Chun Fat visited Hon Ki. In an attempt to impress the actor, Leong made the whipped coffee drink. The actor loved it, which sent people to the struggling cafe to try the drink themselves. It briefly became known as Yao Chow Yun Fat Coffee, according to CNN. Though the effects of that fame were temporary, the hand-stirred coffee remains the cafe's signature item, judging by its reviews on TripAdvisor. Sorry, I misread that. I thought that it was a Chow Yun Fat making the coffee. But apparently he got in on it early into things as well. So Chow Yun Fat, the hipster, who would have known? But then this article goes on to muddy the waters of the origin of this type of coffee a bit more, that it's also quite common in India, a few other parts of Southeast Asia, even a Libyan drink. It even links to a YouTube video that's a couple of years old saying how to make, I believe it was like an Indian cappuccino. So it seems like this type of coffee, the methods for making it have been around for a while and that a few different people have come up with it before. So it may not have a strict origin because no one person from one place came up with it. But if you've got nothing better to do, it actually looks like it'd be a sweet drink. There's a lot of sugar in there. It's a bit of work, and if you nailed it, it'll look good on your Instagram. Another article again here. I just got this one from SBS, but this one was going all over the place, which is, of course, Elizabeth Warren endorses Joe Biden for US president. That, of course, much like a lot of what she did in her campaign, she waited till it was too late and too far gone to actually be meaningful in any capacity. A big thing that will be of note here is that she did this about a week after Bernie Sanders announced that he was suspending his campaign and endorsed Joe Biden. And then, as the article says here, a day later, former President Barack Obama announced his public backing of Biden. So with all this, it really just stinks of these people weren't sure how the campaign was going to go, and they waited until Bernie dropped out to finally endorse Biden because they weren't sure who was actually going to be the nominee. Now that Biden is pretty much more than just the presumptive, that they're throwing all of their backing behind him. But they didn't want to do it until they knew for sure. Really, really inspiring stuff there by the American political class. And it seems like the first time Obama's done anything since he's left office. All right, let's change the tone a little bit again. This article here from The Verge. Disney Plus's butt cover-up hides a much bigger problem. So this one, if you're not on Twitter and not aware of what happened, there's a scene in Touchstone Pictures' 1984 movie Splash where a young Tom Hanks watches a beautiful naked mermaid run off into the ocean from which she came. In the original version, that scene's done from Tom Hanks' perspective. You see this naked woman run off. She's naked, so you see a bum. No big deal. But apparently what's happened is in the Disney Plus version, they put in some rather terrible CG hair to cover it. And so this has sparked a wider conversation around censorship and who owns what you can see now that everything's moving to streaming services. because there's some weird inconsistencies here that they've talked about, such as that if Disney really had a problem with you seeing bums in their old school movies, that they could have always just put it on Hulu, which is a much better place for more adult, not even adult content, but if you wanted something to be PG-13 instead of just PG, that they could put it on there. That in Thor Ragnarok, that the whole scene where you see Hulk's ass isn't censored. And then what makes it even weirder again is a new version of Star Wars A New Hope appeared on Disney Plus the day the streaming service launched, one that was made by George prior to the Disney acquisition, the company confirmed to The Verge at the time. But Disney has also instituted pre-roll messages that play before certain movies to inform viewers that scenes have been edited for specific reasons. The company also removed the word fuck from movies like Adventures in Babysitting and Free Solo. So they'll use a non-Disney version of Star Wars, but then they go back and edit other movies that they made themselves to somehow make them more acceptable, when they're on a streaming platform where ratings don't really matter. It's something that's been consistently happening, and that you know that a company like Disney is going to be a lot worse for it because of the image that they like to cultivate. Another thing that's mentioned here, which is a bit of a complex issue, is last March, Simpsons producer James L. Brooks announced that future syndication packages, streaming, and future DVD releases will not include the Season 3 premiere episode Stark Raving Dad. The episode includes voice acting from Michael Jackson. So the biggest thing there is that they finally actually confirmed that it was Michael Jackson that episode, however, we'll never be able to see it again. This was done in, the early 90s, when we didn't know exactly what was going on with Michael Jackson, or at least it wasn't that well known and no one wanted to talk about it. But I remember that episode, and that was a decent episode, but we won't be able to see it again because of, it's been retroactively removed because of the accusations against him. And as things are popping up more and more about certain public figures, and we try to censor their work, that this is just going to become a lot more common. It really just seems like that further down the line, you're not going to be able to watch, see, or do anything, because as a trend seemed to indicate, everybody involved in show business is absolutely terrible. And as the article concludes here, that retroactively editing films to suit a certain narrative or niche is an ongoing problem that's caused concern in movie, television, and music circles. Because this is the problem. If you don't know what's going on with a certain person, and they produce some stuff, and then accusations come out later, what do you do with what's already out there? That do you remove it completely and just try to hide it away from people? Do you try to acknowledge it in some degree? Because that's the example cited here about Tom and Jerry, that Warner Brothers put a disclaimer at the start of it, saying the certain scenes when they were released are a bit intense and not entirely in line with the company now, what they would depict, but they still show it. It's a wider issue. I feel like if things are already out there, that we should keep it going, make it available, but it's more about limiting the access to those people going forward and not giving them the opportunity to keep creating things if what they do with the power of money and influence that comes with that, is a negatively affecting society. It's a hard one, and it sits in a weird space because it's about what people do personally rather than professionally, but it's one of those things where we should really more going forward try to regulate things so we don't let those sort of people attain a level of status where we need to have these sorts of debates. All right, let's lighten things up. Here's a positive one I got from CNET.com. Flamingos have close friendships that can last for years, scientists say. So, yeah, this was an article done by the UK's University of Exeter and published the results of a 5-year study into flamingo friendships. So this is, wouldn't it be great to get funding for that? To look at flamingos and determine whether they can be friends or not. as a quote from the article says here, some mating couples spend much more of their time together, but lots of other social bonds also exist, said lead author Paul Rose. We see pairs of males or females choosing to hang out. We see trios and quartets that are regularly together. And it also goes on to say that the larger a flock of flamingos, the more friends they have, which, you know, just makes sense. And it really, this article culminates into saying that the biggest takeaway here is if zoos or any other enclosures are going to have flamingos, the more the better. And I think that's just a good takeaway, that the answer to everybody's problem is more flamingos. Here's another one, another article that I got from the ABC, but when this broke, it was going around all over the place. High Court throws out AFP warrant against News Corp journalist Annika Smethurst. So this one, if you remember last year, was a big deal that the Australian Federal Police, they raided both the ABC and Annika Smethurst's house in regards to some articles that they wrote. I believe it was about the army. I forget, like around the Defence Force. But they busted in and went through all their shit and just took stuff. Here are the key points though, to this article. The court found the warrant used to search Ms. Smethurst's home was not correctly issued. The saga sparked concerns over press freedom, but the court did not rule on that issue. And Ms. Smethurst reports examined plans to expand spying powers. So it's all this. That they were looking into how the police were surveilling people. The police decided to raid the offices and homes of journalists looking into them. And as part of this article that I read, that the courts ruled, okay, this is the courts, ruled that the police could keep all the information that they found. So they said that what they did was not above board, they shouldn't have done it, but they're allowed to keep all the things that they obtained through this illicit raid. So it's not really teaching them much of a lesson. And regardless of the outcome of this, going technically in Ms. Smethurst and the ABC's favour, that we shouldn't expect it to be any discouragement from the police doing it again. Okay, here's one from Slate.com. And it's a bit of a twist. Florida governor expands pandemic essential services to include professional wrestling. Yes, that's right. So your WWE is now an essential service that needs to persist on despite this pandemic. As it says here, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, which I'll also note that I saw a GIF of him putting on a face mask, where instead of putting the two loop parts over his ears, he put one over his head so it would sit across the bridge of his nose. So we've got the best possible people looking after Florida right now. Since the outset, has taken a lackadaisical approach to the coronavirus. The state famously let spring breakers continue to rage on its beaches even as the rest of the country hunkered down at home. So he hasn't shown too much interest in cracking down on coronavirus, as it said here, that he's probably one of those people who doesn't think that it's real or that the threat isn't as urgent as people have said, and that as a result, he's let wrestling go ahead, as the article states here. The order signed last week applies, technically, to employees at professional sports and media production with a national audience, including any athletes, entertainers, production team, executive team, media team, and any others necessary to facilitate, including services supporting such production, only if the location is closed to the general public. So it means that WWE is allowed to go ahead because they are critical to Florida's economy, it says, but they can't have any audience or any crowd. So it's just going to be two guys in a ring in the middle of the stadium throwing each other around and getting sweaty. So, yeah, I'm sure that would make for great pay-per-view. As the article also says here, the governor, often referred to as a mini-Trump, is granting this lucrative exemption to the WWE, which is owned by Trump boosters, and this is where there's a typo spotted here, says Vince McMahon, that should be Vince McMahon, whose wife, Linda McMahon, served in the Trump cabinet and runs a Trump 2020 super PAC. This is where this article gets interesting. That you wouldn't think it on the surface, but the WWE has a very close relationship with the Trump administration, because, as it mentioned here, that Linda McMahon actually used to work in the Trump White House. That they, because of that, they have a close relationship. You may not be up on your WWE history, but there was a moment where Donald Trump actually bought, I believe it was Raw, from Vince McMahon, the wrestling TV show. And then during a very scripted bit, Vince McMahon had to buy it back from him after he promised to be too generous to all the audience with the celebrity announcers and ticket refunds and everything. And then later on, Donald Trump ended up getting hit with a Stone Cold Stunner by Steve Austin himself. There's pictures of the whole McMahon family, including Vince, Shane, Sophie, Linda, and Triple H in the White House with Donald Trump. Yeah, the shit's just crazy. So this is old Vince here pulling the strings. My brother and I have joked that he is going to be the what do they call themselves there in the States? The titles like the secretary. He's going to be the secretary of storylines there in the Trump White House. I'm really surprised that they're not consulting him on how to run the narrative in the lead up to this election. Anyway, here's a quick one I'll just gloss over. This one's from The Conversation. It says, 4 ways to be a good landlord in a time of coronavirus. One thing that really annoyed me with this one is it keeps talking about like mum and dad investors as if they're the main people who are being most adversely affected by the coronavirus right now. And that even then, it's not as if a lot of these people didn't already own their places for years and paid them off years ago and are still extorting rent out of their tenants. Because that was definitely the case in at least 2 of the cases that I used to live in, that they were owned by these old people who would technically be regarded as small-scale property investors, but had owned them for so long that they'd paid off any debts associated and all the rent they were getting after that was just free money. But let's quickly gloss over the notes here. 4 ways landlords can help. Here are some ideas in response to our questions of rental stakeholders. Talk directly with tenants if you can, or at least ask to be included in the conversation. You know, I got in touch with my real estate agent asking what the financial situation was with my landlord and how badly they needed my rent. They said that my landlord's financial situation was none of my business, and I was to keep paying rent as per usual until I didn't have any money left and had to go on government support. So, straight up there, that most landlords don't seem to give a shit about tenants and just want that money. Everyone will have different pressures. Work out what position you are in. Find out what concessions your bank may be offering, what inflexible costs, such as council rates you have, what landlord insurance covers you for, and how much the pain you are prepared to share, and for how long. Ask your tenants to do the same. This will form a good and hopefully fair basis on which to compromise. Yeah, everybody has different pressures, because what happens to a landlord if they can't afford their payments? They have to sell the house. What happens to a tenant if they can't pay their rent? They get kicked out. So you've got one person who is selling the extra house they have that they don't live in and have very little to do with so that they can get extra money, versus someone who is paying to live somewhere and if they fail to make those payments, gets kicked out and has nowhere secure to sleep. So yes, everybody has different pressures. Let's just focus on who has the greater pressures. Use letting agents to reflect your values as a landlord. You may wish to have a chat to your agent and ask that they notify you if your tenants are having trouble. Some landlords have gone further and requested that all communication between agent and renter is cleared by them first. So yeah, that's pretty much saying that you can ask your real estate agent not to talk to your tenant until they talk to you. So you can tell them what to say and coordinate your message. And this is pretty much, using your real estate agent as an intermediary so you don't have to talk to your tenant directly and understand how your rent is ruining their life. This whole article is just fucking bullshit and does nothing to encourage landlords to actually act like human beings and help another person instead of just extracting money from them until they fucking die. This one here. Share success stories. One of the motivations for this article is the lack of information for mum and dad investors, and see, there's the fucking line right there, who are trying to be good landlords. Options to offer tenants as part of negotiations might include rent reductions or deferred rent, but there aren't many examples of what other landlords have done out there. Yeah, part of the problem there is that we've lived in this whole neoliberal structure where we just think line goes up means world more gooder, and no one has thought about what would happen in the event that there was some massive failure, I don't know, like something that just happened 10 years ago, which may affect some people's ability to pay rent. You know, rent, the fucking thing, which is classified by accountants as unearned income. That, oh no, what happens if people who just have a shit ton of debt suddenly can't get any of the income that they didn't earn on those assets to pay off the cheap credit they were given by the bank? So look, no fucking sympathy from me. If you're a landlord, the best thing you can do, if you're worried about the fucking payments on the place, is maybe cede that place to the tenant so that then they don't have additional costs and maybe don't have to move back in with their parents after all this, and then you lose a tenant completely. Whatever. Unfortunately, the next thing that I've got tabbed up here isn't a very nice news either. It says, Mort Drucker passes away at 91. So, Mort Drucker, he's one of the illustrators at Mad Magazine, says that he joined the magazine in 1956. And not only did he just work on Mad Magazine, he also drew the JFK coloring book. And here's an interesting one. And the primary poster for George Lucas's American Graffiti. And then his illustration for a 1970 Time magazine cover, Battle for the Senate, eventually landed in the National Portrait Gallery, where it remains today. That also, I remember in the Mad parody of Harry Potter, that Voldemort's name was renamed to Druckermort, which I thought was a bit funny, because I knew who the artist was. And that there's also, I forget which album it is, but he drew the band Anthrax for one of their releases. So that's a bit of sad news. Mort Drucker had a very distinctive style, a very funny guy, did some good stuff. But yeah, unfortunately, yeah, fella was 91, and it wasn't even coronavirus that got him, so at least there's that. Here's another one from the ABC. The government wants you to switch from Netflix to an online short course during coronavirus isolation. I'll just flick over this one real quick because it was of interest, but once you read the article, it's not all that great. These are courses that go for 6 months and they cost from $1,250 to $2,500. So they're not even free, but that might be a bit of a motivator for you if you want to try do some online courses at the moment and, you know, actually start. They're just in your regular things, teaching, nursing, psychology, English, mathematics, foreign languages, agriculture, allied health, other health, information technology, architecture and building science, engineering, medical science, environmental studies. You can go do those if you want. There's some eligibility there, which of course is just more hoops to jump through to make yourself more employable when there's a fucking pandemic going on that has crashed the economy. But that'll be in the show notes. You can look at it if you want. It's not the sort of thing that I'm too interested in. Here's another one from The Verge, which I found interesting. It sort of ties to some of the work I've been doing in my current contract. Why we're still relying on a century-old strategy to treat COVID-19. And what this strategy is caregivers are resorting to using century-old convalescent plasma therapy, siphoning blood from survivors and reinfusing it into the sick. But I've looked into some case studies around cancer treatment for the work that I'm doing currently, and that's pretty much the whole approach here. That someone's plasma is full of a lot of the antibodies that they have for any diseases that they encounter, the specific one here being COVID-19, and that in lieu of an actual manufacturable and scalable vaccine, the solution people have been turning to is just quite literally getting the blood and plasma from someone who has had the virus and recovered it and injected it into someone else who hasn't had it or is currently enduring it. Because then their plasma will be full of the antibodies, and the hope is that the new person who has been injected will take on those antibodies, will be able to replicate them and fight the virus faster. As the article says, after someone is infected with a virus like the novel coronavirus and recovers, their blood is rich with antibodies that their immune system produced to help them fight the virus. Doctors hope that giving the antibody-infused blood plasma to a newly sick person who may not have antibodies yet could help them get better more quickly. With plasma, we're leveraging the body's amazing ability to develop antibodies and immunity to pathogens, Bennett Guerrero says. We transfer those protective factors to people who are sick and haven't been able to mount an immune response. So, yeah, I've read some stuff about doing the same thing with cancers, where the scientists will get cells and materials with cancer antibodies in them. They then attach them to stem cells and have them exchange that genetic data and then create more cells with those antibodies in them. That's what they do in the lab and when they develop a vaccine. This is doing it the old school way, where you just quite literally get the plasma, because that's another thing that I've studied, and well, not studied, but I've read about, is say when you go to get a blood test, what they're actually testing is your plasma, not the blood cells, because that's got all the stuff in it. So same deal here. It's the plasma that carries the antibodies, and that's the main thing you want to inject into other people. I'm just wondering there that because they're doing the plasma and not just the blood, does there need to be a blood type matching, or can you just inject into anyone? This article didn't explain that, but I'm sure that's something, if you looked into it in your own time, you'd be able to find out. The final bit that I highlighted here in the article says, for example, every person who survives an infection will have a slightly different mix of immune substances in their plasma. Each sick person treated with plasma then is getting a slightly different treatment. That can make it really difficult for researchers to tell whether plasma therapy is generally effective or ineffective, or whether it depends on a patient gets a really good or bad batch of plasma. Medical researchers are trying to address this issue by only allowing survivors with high levels of antibodies to donate plasma, but the plasma will still vary from donor to donor. So that's the thing. This is the best solution we have for the moment, but it's not perfect, and that's why not everyone is just going, once someone recovers, let's just get their blood and share around that plasma. It can work, but it doesn't work with the same degree of effectiveness as a vaccine, and so that's what we need to try work towards. I've just got an article here about Bernie Sanders endorsing Joe Biden, but I've already discussed that. What's this one here? Yeah, here's another one I'll go over quickly from the conversation. Hotels are no luxury place to detain people seeking asylum in Australia. So, since this virus has been such an excuse for people to get racist, that you can bring up this article that lets people know that it's no luxury situation. Because, I mean, think about it. If you've ever even just seen a nice hotel, sure, they've got good facilities, but people are stuck in their rooms. And if you've seen a hotel room before, imagine being stuck in there, not just all day, but multiple days at a time. As it says here about asylum seekers stuck in Brisbane, Melbourne, are typically held two or more to a room under the constant watch of security officers. They're allowed to use the hotel's gym facilities for only a few hours a day at most. In order to physically go outside, those held at Kangaroo Point Central or the Mantra Bell City must be transferred by bus to other immigration sites in Brisbane and Melbourne after being subjected to body pat-downs where they may briefly access the exercise areas. Independent reviews of the detention situation in Australia are relatively minimal and infrequent, so they can't even go outside on-site at the hotels where they're being kept. And if they want to go outside to do anything, that they need to go on a bus to a detention facility where they are rigorously pat down and checked, I don't even know what for, maybe to make sure that they're not smuggling any of the virus out of the site with them. I don't know what the point of that is. But it's not, the main takeaway is, sure, they're in hotels, but it's not nice conditions. And they're not in a hotel under the same circumstances as regular people use hotels for. As it says, visits to detainees have been suspended, as well as transfers to the Brisbane and Melbourne immigration centres for outdoor recreation time. The cramped conditions in hotel rooms, common spaces and eating areas have not been addressed. The Ombudsman has now been banned from conducting inspections. Across the globe, calls and petitions have been made to decarcerate or reduce the number of people in prisons and detention centres in light of COVID-19. So, they're being cramped in hotel rooms, common areas and eating areas, and no one's allowed to look into it and ask any questions. So, imagine if you were stuck in a hotel, you weren't allowed to leave your room, and you had to crowd in with everybody else in the hotel at the same time to eat your meals. It's pretty much jail with carpet. And as it also says here, a guard at Kangaroo Point Central tested positive for COVID-19 on March 18th. So they're trying to lock down the immigrants when it's actually the guards that are catching the disease. Let's see. Here's another one that was somewhat important. Why is it so hard to stop COVID-19 misinformation spreading on social media? This one was a bit of an interesting read because I think in light of the 2016 election that all the social media websites are actually putting a bit of fucking effort into this one. As the article says, Facebook has traditionally taken a less proactive approach to countering misinformation. A commitment to protecting free expression has led the platform to allow misinformation in political advertising. We all remember that. More recently, however, Facebook's spam filter inadvertently marked legitimate news information about COVID-19 as spam. While Facebook has since fixed the mistake, this incident demonstrated limitations of automated moderation tools. And this is the problem that we have. Everything on these social media websites is automated. They don't want to put any effort into monitoring what goes on their own websites. And that it's so easy for people to circumvent any of the measures that people put in place, and that we then have to deal with misinformation spreading much faster and much more rampant than the actual truth of the situation. This article goes on to talk about the example of, let me get this guy's official job title here. No, I can't seem to find it quickly, but Dan Scavino, who has some involvement with the Republican Party, how he shared a doctored video of Joe Biden, which part of a sentence was edited to make it sound as he was forecasting Donald Trump's re-election. That right underneath the video, 18 hours after it was posted, Twitter put a little manipulated media tag, which was blue to blend in with the rest of the Twitter theme, and was only available to Dan's actual followers, not anyone else who saw the video. So that shows you the bare minimum that these social media websites are willing to put in to try to control the misinformation on their sites to any degree. And then there are four key reasons why Twitter and other platforms' attempts to label misinformation have been ineffective. First one here is because they use automated algorithms, misinformation scales well. But the manipulated media tag requires human labor, as algorithms cannot decipher complex human interactions. So they need actual people to put the effort in to look at what's going around and add these tags, but they don't like to invest in human labor. Second, that as this video was, the tweets can be shared millions of times before being labeled. Even if removed, they can be easily edited and then reposted to avoid algorithmic detection. It only takes a little bit of playing around with these sorts of videos to technically create something new that can't just be automatically picked up and then can just be shared again. And the third point here, I think is really the big one, is that these labels can be counterproductive, only serving to pique the audience's interest. But conversely, labels may actually amplify misinformation rather than curtailing it. Part of the big problem is when you have people who don't trust mainstream media sources and don't trust the administrators of the websites that they persistently use, when something is labeled as manipulated media, that they feel like that tag is pushing an agenda, not the doctored video that they're watching. So unfortunately, when something is posted as an unreliable source, to some people, it then becomes more reliable because they think that the people handing out those labels are the ones trying to push a certain point. And then finally, the creators of deceptive content can deny their content was an attempt to obfuscate and claim unfair censorship, knowing that they will find a sympathetic audience within the hyperpartisan arena of social media. So again, like this video, this was just a video with a line taken out to make it look like Joe Biden was endorsing Donald Trump. The old mate Dan there could just say that he was sharing the video. He didn't realize what was that it was changed anyway, and maybe that he didn't think that the way people took it is the way that he intended it. It's easy to come up with bullshit. So unless the content is taken down, that there's no way to effectively curtail its spread with labels or anything else. And the last two here, this one from CNET again, is just a more in-depth recipe for that Dalgona coffee, if you're interested to try. And then finally, there's an interesting bit of something different. This one from The Verge again. Razer's Pikachu earbuds come in a Pokeball case for all your charging needs. So yeah, just imagine yellow AirPods with a picture of Pikachu on, what do you call it? The end of the stem of AirPods, right where the speaker part starts. And the charge case for them is shaped like a Pokeball. I don't know how they'd sound, but really, that's not the point, is it? Well, that's everything that I wanted to get through. This has only run a little bit longer than I initially planned, so it's gone pretty well. Let me just alt-tab back over to my recording software, and this episode of What's in Your Pocket can be considered done.